Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll look at American politics and American food. The connections we'll make will be loose ones. We won't spend the show analyzing the Farm Bill. And we'll hear from some interesting people, including Alexander Coburn and Glenn Ford. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's officially summer. Well, not for my listener in Australia, but for the rest of us. I'm out on my bicycle more, and out on the motorcycle more than that. When I ride, I need a destination. Well, some farms have stands that sell to the public. That'll do nicely. Some farm stands even are on the honor system. Take what you want, put your money into a slot in a lockbox. If you need change, there's an open box with some cash in it. Amazing. So I've gotten out into the country. Here in Connecticut, the country is patches here and there, but I've been to some of it. I found some excellent strawberries and lettuce and some very decent spinach and my first ever kale, which is not bad at all if you eat it fresh enough. Everything has been better than the mass-produced crap that supermarkets call produce. In a few more weeks, the corn and green peppers should be coming in. Still later, the kids that I petted should be goat meat. As I'm braising them, I'll try not to dwell on how cute and friendly they were in their youth. I'll probably succeed, too. After all, few animals are cuter than baby pigs, and back in my Iowa days, I used to love watching them scamper around a barnyard. Yet I still ate pork. You had to in Iowa. It was a major crop, right after corn. Anybody who didn't eat pork was suspected of being either a communist or a rabbi. Well, Iowa already had about 6 rabbis, and maybe 3 communists, but I was already a bearded college professor, so why press my luck? Actually, Iowa was a pretty tolerant, even liberal place in the 1980s, and I don't think they minded rabbis or even communists, especially Russian communists, who were good enough to buy lots and lots of Iowa corn and soybeans. Then one day, President Jimmy Carter, a farmer himself, embargoed grain exports to the Soviet Union. Why? It seems that Russian troops had invaded Afghanistan. The United States was not going to stand idly by while the freedom and democracy-loving people of Afghanistan were being annoyed and even shot by some foreign power. No siree! We believed strongly in Afghani independence and self-determination. Let Afghanistan be Afghanistan and leave Afghanistan alone. Iowa had helped elect Jimmy Carter. But with the big Russian export market suddenly cut off, the price of Iowa corn and soybeans plunged. And that was the end of the Democratic Party in the Midwest, and Jimmy Carter in particular. In comes Ronald Reagan, and it's morning in America. Good morning, good morning. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Now, President Jimmy Carter was no liberal. Especially in the second half of his term, he began to dismantle social democracy in America and weaken the social safety net. Then Ronald Reagan came in and stepped up the pace. The destruction of our social democracy continued under every president since, Democrats Clinton and Obama as much as the 2 Republican Bushes. So, you see, you can't talk about food without drifting into politics. And maybe vice versa. Today we'll talk about politics, about how bad things have gotten for the 99%, thanks to political moves that favored the rich. And if time permits, we'll talk about how bad the food has gotten, too. And for the same reasons. Let's start with a quick survey, a sampling of the ways this country has changed for the worse during our lifetimes. We'll start with a brief commentary by one of our sharpest political observers, Glenn Ford, of Black Agenda Report. After that, I'll read a nice essay by Paul Burkite called Five Facts That Put America to Shame. And then more from Glenn Ford. Here's Ford now with a nice comparison of the United States and Europe.
Thanks to the U.S. corporate media's great skills of obfuscation, omission, and just plain lying, Americans are quite confused about the political and financial crisis in Europe and what it means on this side of the Atlantic. People in the United States harbor vague fears that the social turmoil they see playing out in European elections and on the streets may come here. This scares them, which is almost funny in a very sad way, since what European working people are struggling to avoid is being forced to live like most Americans, at the total mercy of the rich. Europeans are righteously upset because they have something quite precious to lose, a social safety net that provides levels of security that Americans have never experienced and that many cannot even imagine. Since many overworked or underemployed Americans don't know how Europeans actually live, they find it difficult to understand what all the fuss is about. U.S. corporate media fill in the vast blanks in American consciousness with slanders against Europe, including the relatively comfortable French and the devastated Greeks alike, branding them all lazy slackers who don't want to work hard or pay their bills. America's damn near non-existent social welfare structures are packaged as a virtue, while the sights and sounds of European protest are made to seem ominous, dangerous, selfish. Most Americans of modest means don't travel to countries where the people live better than they do, or are so oblivious that they don't notice the deep social service networks that underlie these societies. Americans cannot understand, for example, that higher educational achievement is so often tied to strong national compacts among citizens and fundamental notions of social equality, these qualities being absent in American life. CNN is quick to cite figures on European unemployment, but tells its U.S. audience virtually nothing about the social safety net that makes unemployment in Europe a very different experience than being without a job in the United States. A young relative of mine happened to graduate with a professional degree just in time for the 2008 meltdown, which wiped out all the new jobs in his profession. He sought work in France, being fluent in the language, and found it a far more welcoming society than his own. More than half of his rent was subsidized, because the French believed that people younger than 26 should have a chance to begin independent lives without undue burdens. My young Black American relative rode public transportation for half fare, as did his young French peers below the age of 26. While working, he considered getting another professional degree, which would have cost him less than $2,000 a year at a fairly prestigious French school. And he was a foreigner. A French student who was already paid into the healthcare system could study for a year for less than $1,000. My young relative eventually came home because, well, this is home. It is a materially rich country, but one that is socially impoverished, and frankly, too ignorant to know it. Europe is headed for deep turmoil because Europeans have something to defend. They'll fight to keep a decent social welfare net. The Americans don't even know what a minimally just society looks like or feels like. We'll have to create that society through struggle. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Playing off that, here's a nice essay that appeared in Common Dreams on May 14. It's by Paul Burkite, and it's called Five Facts That Put America to Shame. Fact number one, we're near the bottom of the developed world in children's health and safety. According to a 2007 UNICEF report, the U.S. ranked last among 21 developed countries in child health and safety. The study measured infant mortality, immunization, and death from accidents and injuries. A 2009 study generally agreed, placing the U.S. 24th out of 30 advanced countries for children's health and safety. When it comes to child poverty, we ranked 27th out of 30. Fact number two, we've betrayed the young people who are advised to stay in school. Over 40% of college graduates are living with their parents, dealing with government loans that average $27,200. The unemployment rate for young people is about 50%. More than 350,000 Americans with advanced degrees applied for food stamps in 2010. Meanwhile, U.S. corporations are just sitting on $2 trillion in cash while looking for investments and employees in foreign countries, while American students are forced to accept menial positions. And conservatives are all bubbly about today's young entrepreneurs, quote, creating their own jobs, unquote. Jobs that, quote, don't yet exist, unquote. Fact number three, the main source of middle-class wealth has been largely wiped out. American homeowners owe almost as much as students, with $700 billion of debt over and above the value of their homes. This removes the only source of wealth for middle America, especially for blacks and Hispanics. For every dollar of non-home wealth owned by white families, people of color have only 1 cent. So when minority families were specifically targeted for high-risk subprime loans that could be repackaged and sold for a quick profit, most of their assets were erased. Median wealth fell 66% for Hispanic households and 53% for black households. For whites, the decline was 16%. One of the chief architects of this grand theft was Sanford Weil. He's the banker largely responsible for repealing the mortgage-protecting Glass-Steagall Act. Weil was just elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences for his, quote, extraordinary achievement and a call to serve, unquote. Fact number four, we give prison sentences for smoking marijuana, but not for billion-dollar fraud. About half of our world-leading prison population is in jail for nonviolent drug offenses. Americans have also been arrested for handing out free food in a park. Mothers in Ohio and Connecticut have been jailed for enrolling their kids in out-of-district schools. As of 2003, in California, there were 344 people serving sentences of 25 years or more for shoplifting. How does the market deal with the steady tide of petty crime? It strives for more. The new trend of private prisons is dependent on maintaining a sizable prison population to guarantee profits, with no incentive for rehabilitation. As the number of inmates has surged, the people who have devastated countless American lives get out of jail free. The savings and loan fraud some years back cost the nation between $300 billion and $500 billion, about 100 times more than the total cost of burglaries in 2010. The financial system bailout has already cost the country $3 trillion. Goldman Sachs packaged bad debt, sold it under a different name, and then bet against their own financial creation by selling it short. Other firms accused of fraud and insider trading were Morgan Stanley, Bear Stearns, Bank of America, Countrywide Financial, and Wells Fargo. By 2008, the Justice Department had postponed the bribery or fraud prosecutions of over 50 corporations. Instead, it entered into agreements involving fines and monitoring periods. Fact number five. You can have health care if you pay for it. A recent study compared U.S. health care spending to 12 other advanced countries. The data show that reducing our costs to the median level of spending of these 12 would save us $1.5 trillion a year. This is more than our entire deficit. But insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and hospital companies won't hear of it. There's too much money to be made. Bypass surgery in the U.S. costs 2 to 3 times more than in Great Britain, Canada, France, and Germany. Cataract surgery costs 4 times more. That's if you can pay for it. There are currently about 50 million uninsured Americans. At the other extreme are $2,400 a day penthouse hospital suites, complete with butler and grand piano. The Annual Review of Public Health noted that, quote, the health rankings of the United States have declined substantially when compared with other nations, unquote. Conclusion: privatization simply has not worked for healthcare, mortgage banking, higher education, or prison management. There is little incentive for profit-motivated firms to invest in disadvantaged or underemployed Americans. That's why taxes are necessary, to provide for the common good and to return some of the gains from 60 years of productivity growth to the great majority of Americans who contributed to that growth. So ends 5 Facts That Put America to Shame. This show needs some lightening up. Here's David Rovics with a happier vision.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles, we're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison doors swung open, mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air, and Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution.
In 5 Facts That Put America to Shame, Paul Burkite talked about Wall Street's real estate bubble and mortgage swindle. Glenn Ford has some information on that that is new to me. Did you know that, as part of the TARP bailout, Congress appropriated billions of dollars to help homeowners struggling with their mortgages? And did you know that Obama refused to spend that money? Why? Well, because helping homeowners is not really what Obama's bosses, the big bankers, wanted. Here's Glenn Ford.
The Obama administration's indifference to the plight of foreclosed homeowners and total subservience to the banks is once again on public display. According to a report by the Special Inspector General of the TARP program, the administration has spent only a tiny fraction of the money that it was allocated to help those most negatively impacted by the housing collapse. In 2 years, only a little over 30,000 households have been helped at a cost of $217 million. That's only 3% of the $7.6 billion TARP is authorized to spend through its hardest-hit fund. No wonder most people think TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Fund, is only concerned with bailing out the banks. The Obama administration has treated it that way, even though Congress intended a portion of that money to help homeowners recover from the damage the banks had done. From the day he was sworn in, and even before that, on the campaign trail, Obama has behaved as if the welfare of the banks is all that matters. Tim Geithner, the man he appointed to head the Treasury Department, which in turn runs the TARP program, is a former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. A previous inspector general of TARP reported back in the summer of 2009 that the bank bailout might cost as much as $24 trillion, approaching twice the size of the gross domestic product of the United States. $7.4 trillion of that money was to come out of TARP and other Treasury Department programs. That's more than 1,000 times more money than the $7.6 billion set aside for the hardest-hit homeowners. But Geithner couldn't even bring himself to spend that paltry sum on TARP's hardest-hit fund. So almost all of the money has been sitting there, doing nothing for anybody for the last 2 years. Obama apologists will probably claim that the president didn't know that his Treasury Secretary was withholding billions of dollars in aid to the worst-hit victims of the housing crisis, which means, of course, they'll believe anything. The reason Geithner didn't spend the hardest-hit fund money is because he, like other bankers, believes that helping homeowners in crisis amounts to tampering with the market, a euphemism for Wall Street. Obama thinks that way, too. In early 2008, Obama alone, among the three Democratic presidential candidates in the running, rejected out-of-hand proposals for a moratorium on home foreclosures. He didn't want to put a cap on mortgage rates, either. Candidates John Edwards and Hillary Clinton supported mandatory or voluntary moratoriums, respectively, but not Obama. He had already made his deal with Wall Street, and he's kept his promise to the super rich. Treasury Secretary Geithner sat on the homeowners' relief money for 2 years because his boss wanted it that way. The Congressional Black Caucus begged Obama to target foreclosure relief funds to areas that were hurt worst by the meltdown, which overlaps with the geography of Black America. That's what the $7.6 billion in the hardest-hit fund was supposed to do. The Black Caucus was shamelessly betrayed by the first Black president. The homes of hundreds of thousands of their constituents could have been saved, but the Obama team outright refused to spend money lying right there in the accounts. What will the caucus do? Pretend that it never happened. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Well, time has slipped away, so let us postpone the pleasure of still more incisive doom and gloom from the likes of Glenn Ford and Alexander Coburn. But as I said, politics leads back to food. Federal farm policy, hand in glove with corporate agribusiness, has given us massive taxpayer subsidies for corn and other grain, which has given us cheap sweeteners, cheap chips and pizza crust, and cheap meat. Want some farm fresh organic strawberries or lettuce? I found some, but they're not cheap, and it's a 30-mile round trip to get them. Want a quarter-pound double cheeseburger on a bun? It's yours in 5 minutes for 99 cents. But you can do worse than that. Here's Jim Hightower.
Attention foodies, let's chow down. There's a new craze in cuisine world, and it's going 180 degrees in the opposite direction from the healthy eating movement we hear so much about. For example, instead of locally sourced beets and jicama on sustainably raised arugula dressed with small batch artisan balsamic vinegar, We're talking a big Pizza Hut pepperoni and gooey cheese pie with, get this, a long looping hot dog stuffed right into the crust. Or, if that's not caloric enough for you, Pizza Hut is also offering a Belt Buster pizza that is ringed by a dozen mini cheeseburgers baked directly onto the crust. Hey, some might see obesity as a crisis, but Yum Brands, Inc., the conglomerate that owns Pizza Hut, sees it as a money-making opportunity. Don't fight it, feed it. Not to be outdone, the Burger King chain is test marketing a stunning advance in fusion cuisine at one of its Nashville outlets. It marries two essential food groups together, ice cream and pork. Yes, America, get ready for the Bacon Sunday, topped off with caramel and chocolate syrup. The pioneering innovator in obesity grub, however, comes from the place where anything goes and too much is never enough. Las Vegas. Many top chefs have opened 4-star restaurants along the Las Vegas Strip, but none can outstrip a local diner when it comes to extravagant excess. The Heart Attack Grill takes pride in deep fried, and its menu is filled with unhealthy eats. Renowned for its quadruple bypass burger, butter fat shakes, and flatliner fries cooked in pure lard, the grill brags that it serves food with, quote, taste worth dying for. Indeed, two diners have collapsed so far this year while pounding down bypass burgers. This is Jim Hightower saying, so weigh in and bon appetit.
Well, I hope it's good Iowa grain-fed pork Burger King is putting into its bacon sundaes, and good Iowa high-fructose corn syrup in it, too. Raised by nice family farmers whose motto, when it comes to rabbis and communists and even college professors, is live and let live, and please keep those corn subsidies coming in. And thank you for listening to our food and politics mashup. New World Notes comes to you by way of the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Until next week, this is Kenneth Doust advising, throw out your local politician, support your local farmer, wash your hands before eating, don't talk with your mouth full, illicitimi non carborundum, and ciao.